You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Giuseppe Licari. He's calling from Rotterdam. Giuseppe, thanks so much for being with me today.
Thanks, Brainerd, for having me.
So let's talk about your work. I know you're in Rotterdam now, but what's happened in the past few months, or what are you working on now?
I just came back from the States, actually, from a residency project I did in Boise, Idaho, which is a state no one knows, but it's basically on the west of the state, and it's a place very much affected by wildfires, which they started in 1985 at the Yellowstone, and now somehow are becoming common and frequent every year, bigger and bigger. And my research was actually about these wildfires, and I had the luck to be there when one of the biggest fire in the history of the area happened, which was the Pioneer Fire. And it happened very close by the city. It was one of the most expensive fires in the history of the Idaho state. And together with California, somehow they are really on the top list for the region suffering by the climate change and by the fires, somehow destroying their forests and putting a threat on the air quality of the area and on the future of their forest. So my project was about this investigation to understand how the forest is maintained, how this dealing with the landscape around the city has been changing through the history of the United States and through the history of the national parks, and then finally to realize an installation inside the exhibition space with trees that have been collected from the fires, from this year fires, so burned trees, which I rearranged in a new composition, creating an indoor forest somehow of these cherry trees in contrast with the white space of the gallery.
So I want to talk more about that show and that space, but Boise, Idaho, yeah, that's a place that, you know, seems to me, I'm on the East Coast now, as very remote, and also a place where there wouldn't be a lot of cultural or artistic activity. Was there, or was this kind of, an isolated residency?
So you are completely right. It's kind of in the middle of nowhere with the 500 miles radius of desert, basically. There is no much culture. But since 3-4 years ago, a patron, Jason Morales, he started a residency program there in Boise, especially for this reason, to bring culture in the city, which is now expanding because San Francisco and Los Angeles are becoming too expensive. So many people are moving from the West Coast to Boise because the quality of life is really high and the nature is amazing. And it's a small city, but somehow they are rebuilding it because it's getting gentrified, and they're sure it's going to grow much bigger in the next 10 to 20 years.
And so the residency was for, you applied to the residency, and how long was the residency for? And were you expected to do an installation there?
So normally you apply to the residency, but in this case I got invited to the residency, and not knowing anything about the area, and knowing that there was no much about culture, I'm always fascinated about the landscape and how the rural area somehow becomes a mirror for political agendas that are applied in the city. And when I realized that actually all these mega fires were happening there, I thought that would be a great challenge for me to really experience directly these huge fires and the landscape they leave behind. So, and then actually I had the project or the proposal ready already a year ago before going there. So we agree on this project, and I got funding from Holland to realize the project. Plus, we got other funding from Boise, and together we managed to do this installation. The residency was 3 months, and the exhibition is up till the 3rd of December in 2016.
So the idea of making the installation with the burned trees and creating a forest was something that you had planned before you went there, was something you had projected?
Exactly. Because this project was inspired by a previous project which I did in 2007, and that was inspired by the forest fires that were happening in that year in Sicily and Greece. And the project was realized in Rotterdam, but then it was one single tree that was somehow cut in pieces, burned, and rebuilt inside the exhibition space. And for a couple of years, I had this idea to recreate actually a burning forest, since this fire has been increasing, or like the forest fires has been becoming a hot topic nowadays. And so when the combination or the invitation came in, it was for me like a challenge, to pursue this project.
And that's, I mean, I want to talk more about past projects, but that experience in Idaho must have been extraordinary. I mean, I have no idea what that's like to be near or in the same area as one of the largest forest fires in history there. What is that like in terms of the physicality of it, and in terms of the environment, the people around you? Is it like the effect of, we know that a national disaster is taking place of epic proportions? Or and is the air filled with smoke? I mean, what is it like there in terms of just the physicality of it?
So exactly. I mean, I went there, and I thought to have built some connection before being there, so that some diplomatic work was done. But actually, I had to do everything from zero. So I started going to the National Forest Department, and finally, I realized how much bureaucracy is involved in the forest, and I had to deal with a lot of red tape surrounding these areas. So the first thing I did was just driving through the burned forest where they opened the roads, and then slowly build contacts with the people, with the firefighters, and with the incident camp, and managed to meet some nice people that were willing to bring me to the actual fire and to document, because I also did the photographic documentation of these fires. And as you said, I mean, the first thing you can see and feel in the city is the smoke. Basically, the forest is burned, and the smoke is the biggest problem after, let's say, the fire that can attack private property. So what I was seeing, especially early in the morning, because until noon, like the cold air above the ground somehow traps the smoke down, and the fire starts burning again after noon. So between 7 and noon, you could experience an amazing landscape, almost reminding me of Japanese landscape, foggy and mist, but actually it was all smoke. And that's pictured with the photo somehow gives the spectator a weird feeling if you don't know, and slowly, suddenly, you can read the traces of the fire. But these fires are so big also because the forest is so ill. So basically, driving through all the burned forest, which is like immense. I mean, you can imagine the entire landscape till the horizon, all your view completely taken by these burned trees that now are remains of what was a forest, and they look like matches, basically, even if they are like 90 feet tall. And then driving around, because it's all closed area, so you cannot get access. It's completely controlled by the ranger districts and by the firefighters. Then I had the possibility to see a forest that haven't been burned in the past, and the trees were looking really very much dead. So then I realized actually how the fire somehow becomes something healthy for this forest. And reading through books and techniques they use in the States to fight the fires, I realized that actually, or I read that actually the Native Americans were already controlling the forest with controlled fires. So they were putting the forest on fire in order to clean from the litter that was on the ground, but also to make sure that only the strong trees would survive, and also to regenerate and fertilize the ground of the forest for a richer plants to sprout and for other seeds to develop. So in a way, like the fire, yes, leaves this scar, which is kind of dramatic, but in another hand, it's like very healthy for the forest. And the biggest problem comes when there are private houses within the national forest that needs to be protected by the fires. Otherwise, the national forest can get sued by the private owners because of the house burned. So how somehow civilization or these settlements developed through the forest somehow increase the risk of fire for people, but actually it stops the fire for the regeneration of the forest.
That's fascinating. So it's but though it's part of a healthy regeneration process as part of the global warming process, is that process still working in a healthy way, the way previous cultures had used it, as you were saying, or is it somehow too large and out of scale to be healthy? I mean, I don't know. I'm just questioning that.
So basically now the national forests changed the way they've been treating the fires. In the past, they were all the time stopping them. And what this created was an unhealthy forest and also a huge amount of litter and branches on the ground, which actually fuels the forest and make it so huge. Of course, like climate change is also an impact because with the increasing of temperature, more storms are affecting this area, and so more fires are starting with the thunder, and so it becomes more difficult to fight them because of the two things, and they've been fighting, trying to stop the fire already for the last 100 years, and now in the last couple of years they are starting to make some preventing fires in order to reduce the litter and the fuel that can create these mega fires, as they are called now. So I'm not sure if actually it's still working, but they are trying. And definitely, you know, it will clean the forest, and especially from these sick trees, you know, because even on these huge fires that have been happening, there are trees which survive, and they stand as a monument into an empty landscape.
And so your installation, you know, in a way, if I understand what you're saying correctly, kind of spoke to this kind of regeneration. The dead forest is actually the new forest in a way. Is that correct?
I mean, I don't know if it was really, let's say, what I did in the installation was to collect several elements from the forest. So I had a list of different burned trees I would like to have, and then reconstructed inside as a composition. The title of the installation was Contrapunto, in English, Counterpoint, which it also refers to music and to the contrast between the black and the white of the gallery, between the wood that is normally fueling the fire and the fire that wants to eat the wood. So in a way, it represents this burned forest as a kind of remain or a monument. In a way, it becomes also a mirror for society, because for me, trees is very much symbolic for people and for humanity. And even though the trees are dead and badly burned, they have, or they give this feeling of still being alive. And somehow they have, or in the spectator comes real, this possibility of them to sprout again. So maybe yes, but it's more a question to the spectator, you know, how this burned forest talk to us, to our society, and also how to bring them in direct contact with the people living in the city, which hear about this fire, but they never really see or experience directly. On another hand, people that live in these areas, they have an emotional approach to the installation, because they think of the smoke, they think of the fires. There were a large community of firefighters who came to the exhibition, and they were remembering awkward moments when they were fighting the fires, and when trees are somehow, the snag trees become so dangerous if they fall on top of you, because 5 people last year got killed. And so it creates a lot of intersection, a lot of contrast somehow between what we should protect and what we shouldn't, and what we are, you know, and where we come from.
So that's how did the audience there react? That was a largely American audience, and that was coming to your installation?
Yeah. So there was a large audience. It was a very popular topic for the area, you know, because they have to deal with these smoke and fires every year. And some people have been fighting on the first line, the fire to protect their own house. And people felt very emotional, very attached to the topic. You know, they know that that actually the fire is healthy for the forest, but on the same way, somehow the fire is treating the city and their own life, because especially the people fighting on the first line, like the smoke jumpers and the firefighters, which I had the luck to meet, and they helped also in the realization of the project. But I mean, and of course all the discussion about climate change and decisions and the pollution that is not made there on the area exactly where these fires are happening, but miles away, if not thousands of miles away. So somehow it's something we have to deal nowadays, not just in Boise, but everywhere in the globe, in order to make sure that our planet stays cool, and that these events, even though they are part of the natural cycle, they still are like under normal condition and not becoming these mega fires that then are unstoppable and burns hundreds of thousands of acres of forest, which takes about 30 years to regenerate.
And were you able to bring any of the installation back with you, or does it remain there?
So that's, yeah, another difficult thing, because at the moment the installation is still on, as I said, until the 3rd of December, and it's always problematic to bring wood or organic material from one continent to the other. We are now talking with the Department of Art and History in Boise to install the piece permanently, maybe at the airport, because Boise is also the city of trees, and in this case it will be the cities of burnt trees. And so people arriving to Boise will have immediately this confrontation with what's happening there and what is somehow one of the biggest topics they are confronting at the moment.
Right, that would be wonderful. So to have it there permanently. So let's go to another... You're primarily, or recently have been working in this kind of form where you're going to do different residencies. Is that the case? Or so we could talk about another residency, or is there something you're making in your studio at the moment that we should talk about?
I mean, as I said, I just came back. Yeah, in the studio I've been working in the past couple of years on a project called Pasta Madre, which is actually a copy of my head made in bread, which then I let it rot, producing molds for several months using different ingredients. So basically I use the same technique used to make bronze sculpture, but then with organic material. And then I use a organic coating, which so far has been yogurt or pig fat or molds, which I've been collecting in the forest and the surrounding of my studio. And then I keep it in a controlled environment to crumble down until I think it's done. And this process has been documented. And finally, the crumble had preserved inside the block of polyester, included into this block. So it's somehow mummified forever. And as you said,
let me just understand that. So the mummification, you're sculpting a head, a bust, a portrait of yourself out of bread, coating it with organic material, and then it's decomposing, and in its final decomposed state or near its final state, it's preserved. But we don't only through documentation can we see the original sculpture. Is that correct?
Yeah, so I use photography as a way to document the process, and then finally, when the head is crumbled down to the point I think is fine or ready, I preserve it in the sense I include it into a polyester. So that's a taxidermy technique. In a way, it's the same when you buy these key holders with the scorpion inside, you know, that is transparent, or when they find insects in the amber. So more or less, let's say it's the same, but then artificial. So I build several layers of this transparent polyester, which preserve and includes the bread head, which later is cleaned and polished to become clear glass, transparent, and the head is preserved. So it's a block, it's like a sculptural.
And so then is that potentially an object that can be sold or a collector can own?
Yeah. So I sold the first head I made, because this is something I do in the studio when I'm not busy with the large installation site specific. And so far I've made 6 different heads, and I'm also learning the process of the composition and how I can manipulate that in order to get different results. So depending on the organic coating you use, you get molds of different colors and of different consistency somehow. And that's something really fascinating, somehow, how bread feeding us goes back to the landscape somehow through this decomposition process, and how somehow this portrait, it becomes representative somehow for the world, because you can see a landscape. It's like if you look at the planet from very far away because of the tiny molds, it's like similar to a forest somehow colonizing the planet.
And this, and that theme or way of working, you know, is also seems related to the installation you've done, and perhaps other work as well, where decomposition and the relationship to the planet is something that you continue to be involved in. Is that true?
Exactly. So yeah, I mean, my main interest is on the public and nature and culture. And I've been for the last 10 years working mainly for a site-specific large installation in which the public is immersed into the artwork, you know, so where the experience becomes the experience of the work. And the memory of it is the only way to remember it, because even the reproduction of the same work in another space will result in a different configuration. So somehow in a different work. And in the past years, I've been developing this project that somehow keeps all the interest I have in my career in general. And then it's something that I can do in my studio and then later just present it as a finished product to the gallery.
And is there a gallery that represents you in Rotterdam where some of these works will be shown in the future?
I don't work fixed with one specific gallery. I've been working for several years with one gallery that is based in Rotterdam, but we don't have a fixed relation. So I work mainly like with commissions, and let's say I like to stay free from any gallery.
And so that's a good point. And why do you like to stay free from any gallery and continue to have commissions? And I'd like to ask about a commission too, but just to ask the politics of that. Why is it important to stay free of any gallery?
I mean, for the moment, the possibility of being free doesn't give you any limit to the practice and to the work you want to produce. While some gallery, they actually request to you specific kind of works or medium you should use, and they are not so willing to accept dramatic changes or strong changes in your practice. And with commission, you can really put all your energy and inspiration of the moment in which you are living and of the ideas you want to realize. It's something that is also very complicated because you need a large budget. So most of the time you need to work with museums or foundations, or you need to apply for funding. And what I would like to reach now is actually more the collector's market, you know, which are the ones somehow ensuring continuity to your practice.
And is there a way to reach the collector's market with going around the kind of structure of the gallery, which, as you're saying, is somewhat restrictive? Would that be through direct relationships with collectors so that there would be direct commissions?
I really don't know yet. I mean, I have some friends which have direct connection to collectors, and of course, like, good galleries is a good bridge between artists and collectors. And some residencies are also very important to bring the artists in touch with collectors and curators. And it's something I'm exploring at the moment.
That's exciting and good to hear. When a commission happens, that is happening through, I mean, maybe we could just speak about one commission before we go. When you have a commission that's coming directly from a collector, is that how it happens? Someone approaches you and asks you to do a particular project or wants to support something? How does a commission come about is what I'm asking, and what would be one example of a commission?
Exactly. I mean, there are different ways. One way is that they approach you and maybe they like a specific work, which they would like to have it in their space. And another is that they like your work in general and they would like to commission you a new work or a new project for their space or for their collection or for a space they're running somehow.
And so taking something like the head that you talked about or even the installation in Idaho, that's something that potentially could be a commission, although albeit an expensive one, because it's process-oriented and it's going to take time for you to put all these things together. Is that correct?
Exactly. It's a commission somehow that came from this foundation, which actually is Ming Studios, but then is under the hands of a collector or of a patron. And finally, we had also to apply for extra funding in order to make sure that the work could be realized. So it's like it's a different way of commissioning because they didn't have the full budget to realize the work, but in a way, it's a commission somehow.
It's been great talking with you, but before we go, Giuseppe, is there a book or books you're reading now that you'd want to share with us? I'm always curious what people are reading.
I mean, there are a couple of books I've been reading, I'm reading at the moment, and one is from a Dutch biologist called Midas Dekker, which is The Way of All Flesh, and he talks really about the planet in which we live and the fascination humanity has always had with the decay and the composition, which I really recommend. I think it's a great book. It talks also about art history and the restoration of artworks, you know, in our contemporary society. And the other book is by Bruno Latour called Politics of Nature, in which he tries to put down on paper, to write down the importance of involving nature and natural elements in our political discussion and how this is something that needs to change in our contemporary political situation in which we are, in order to decide not for ourselves, not only for ourselves, but for the entire group of elements that constitute the planet in which we live and our life.
Those both sound very important. Thanks for sharing those. Giuseppe, I want to thank you for being with me today. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you, Brainerd. Thanks a lot. It's been a pleasure for me, too.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.